Welcome to Kingsley Natalie's podcast on the topic of employee disciplinary procedures, where to draw the line on serious misconduct. This podcast captures the content of our employment team's most recent breakfast briefing. Speaking at the seminar were two of our own employment lawyers, Francesco Lopez and Andreas White, along with Matthew Hardcastle from our criminal litigation practice. We're happy to welcome them here for a summary of what we covered. Jess, you started us off with an introduction on how employers should conduct a fair disciplinary process. Can you run us through what constitutes a reasonable investigation into an employee's conduct?
So the legal test for the purposes of establishing whether or not a disciplinary investigation has been fair and proper is that it has been reasonable in all the circumstances, by reference to the band of reasonable responses. Now, it's very difficult to give hard and fast guidelines as to what this means in practice, but the key thing to bear in mind is that an employer will need to investigate the allegations being levelled against the employee sufficiently such that the substance of the allegations is clear and the employee can respond meaningfully to those allegations. Employers do have some latitude as to what actually constitutes a reasonable investigation, and it will depend upon things like the particular misconduct in question, the gravity of the allegations against the employee, the potential effect of the allegations upon them, the size and administrative resources available to the employer, and whether the employer's actions were within the range of reasonable responses available to a business in the employer's situation, bearing in mind all the circumstances of the matter. It's important to note that an investigation must be even-handed to be reasonable. So in cases that may result in dismissal, for example, the investigation should not simply be a search for evidence in support of the allegations against the employee. It should also involve a search for evidence which may exonerate them. Now, that said, whilst an employer needs to be even-handed, they're not required to pursue every line of possible inquiry. From a pure employment law perspective, the more serious an allegation, the more thorough the investigation needs to be, given the significant impact that serious allegations could have on an employee's reputation or career. But employers aren't under an obligation to leave no stone unturned, for example. It's a question of what is reasonable in the circumstances. Now, on that point, I think it's important that employers recognise any possible criminal angle here, as there is a divergence between pure employment law and best practice on the one hand, and criminal law and best practice on the other hand, which Matt will come on to discuss.
The disciplinary hearing has now taken place, and the judgment has been delivered, which the employee does not like. How long does that employee have to lodge an appeal?
There's no hard and fast rule, and the ACAS Code of Practice on Disciplinary and Grievance Procedures does not specify a time limit. However, the ACAS guidance recommends that a period of 5 working days is reasonable to allow an employee to prepare and submit an appeal. Also, the employer's disciplinary policy ought to state a period of time in this respect. Now, if an employee submits an appeal late, the employer should seriously consider all the circumstances of the matter before deciding whether to reject it as out of time. Whilst an employer may technically be entitled to do so, in line with its policies or procedures, rejecting an appeal would realistically be quite a bold move for an employer to take, and any decision in this respect needs to be considered carefully on the facts.
The appeal has been lodged, and the employer accepts it may proceed. Who would you say should be tasked with conducting it?
It's important to ensure that any appeal which is conducted is done so impartially and is dealt with by someone not previously involved in the disciplinary. Ideally, the person hearing the appeal should be more senior than the person who made the original disciplinary decision. If you think about it, the issue with having someone less senior is that they could simply be seen to be deferring to the decision of their more senior colleague who decided the disciplinary outcome in the first instance. it's also worth ensuring that the individual who hears the appeal is outside the reporting line of whoever made the original disciplinary decision, to avoid allegations being raised at a later date by the employee that the appeal manager was simply rubber stamping the disciplinary decision made by their subordinate as a matter of course, rather than considering the issues properly and with an open mind.
So, stepping back in the process a little, in your experience, what are some of the more common bear traps or pitfalls for employers when conducting an investigation?
One would be failing to put all the evidence in question before the employee, particularly where further investigation has taken place after an adjourned disciplinary hearing, for example. Also, some employers come unstuck when it comes to the appeal stage, so having failed to appoint a sufficiently senior and independent person to conduct the disciplinary hearing, whilst keeping a more senior individual in reserve who has the requisite authority to conduct the appeal with integrity and independence. Other employers have been known to breach their own disciplinary policies and procedures, which is obviously problematic. And a key issue also concerns attempts to influence the investigators or disciplinary decision makers. Now, on this point, if we look at HR, for example, they should make sure that any advice which they are giving to the parties is limited to matters of procedure and process and doesn't stray into areas of culpability or opinion. It's not for HR, for example, to pass judgment on an employee's conduct, nor is it for investigators to do so either. With particular reference to investigators, their role is simply to establish the facts and present those facts to the disciplinary decision makers. There have been cases where the courts have held that people involved in a disciplinary process were interfering or manipulating the conclusions which were being drawn, such that the integrity of the disciplinary process was undermined in its entirety. In one case, for example, the final version of an investigation report, which the employer relied upon when terminating an employee's employment, was found to have been significantly altered in light of HR advice. In another, it was decided that the employee in question ought to receive a written warning. However, significant changes were subsequently made to a disciplinary report by HR, following which the individual was actually found guilty of gross misconduct and summarily dismissed. So one of the key issues for employers is trying to ensure that those involved in the process, whether they are HR, investigators, whoever they may be, are clear of their remit and work within the parameters of that remit.
Many thanks, Jess. Andreas, you spoke about three knotty problems with disciplinaries. The first of these was around the seemingly simple, but actually quite tricky, area of suspension. Are there practical alternatives available to employers which may allow them to avoid actually having to suspend their employees?
Well, the obvious alternative to suspension is allowing the employee under suspicion to remain at work, provided that won't undermine or prejudice the investigation. And perhaps that can happen with additional management support, supervision, monitoring, that sort of thing. It might also be possible to implement a temporary change of department or team, maybe even a change of location. And in some circumstances, you might be able to allocate special projects to the employee, which they might be able to carry out from home, but not actually formally to suspend them from work altogether.
In the seminar, you summarised the decision in Agoreo and London Borough of Lambeth, in which the claimant, a teacher in that case, successfully claimed unfair dismissal following a suspension over her treatment of students. In your view, what did her employer do wrong? And with hindsight, how could they have better handled that situation?
Well, that case involved a primary school teacher accused of using unreasonable force to restrain the disruptive behaviour of a pupil in class, so a really serious allegation. And the employee's case wasn't that the allegations against her shouldn't have been investigated, it was that her suspension wasn't reasonable or necessary in order for a proper investigation to take place. And then later on in litigation, the school sought to justify themselves by reference to their overriding duty of care to their pupils. But that wasn't what they relied on at the time. What they relied on at the time was the need to carry out a fair investigation. And in fact, the court were highly critical, saying that they suspended first and thought later. It was what the courts describe as a knee-jerk reaction. They should have at least put the allegations to the employee and given her an opportunity to give her account, and they also ought to have considered alternatives to suspension.
So, Andreas, to round up on this particular topic, when in your view can a suspension be justified and when can it not?
The first thing you have to ask yourself is, does the employer have the legal power to suspend? And normally that will be contained in the contract or in the handbook. And then it's important to bear in mind that even if the employer has that legal power, their exercise of the legal power to suspend is subject to the implied duty of trust and confidence. So essentially what that means is that the employer has to act fairly and reasonably in reaching the decision to suspend on good grounds. The suspension itself then needs to be kept as short as possible, and it also needs to be kept under review. It's a very good idea to keep in touch with the employee, particularly if the suspension becomes protracted.
The second knotty problem you addressed was around an issue which is very important in practice, and that's the impact of stress on an employee when under investigation. What can an employer do when an employee is or appears to be too stressed to attend a disciplinary meeting?
Well, the ACAS code provides that where an employee is persistently unable or unwilling to attend a disciplinary meeting without good cause, then the employer should make a decision on the evidence available. But of course, if your employee has a doctor's note citing stress, then on the face of it, they have a good reason for non-attendance, and some delay is probably going to be inevitable. In that situation, employers are generally well advised to show some patience, particularly if the employee qualifies for unfair dismissal protection or could be disabled for disability discrimination purposes. Now, if the employee's stress-related absence persists, the next step is to seek a medical report to confirm whether the employee is well enough to attend a disciplinary hearing, and if not, when they're likely to be. Of course, employee consent is required to do that, but if the employee won't give their consent, then that can support the case for proceeding in their absence. It's also worth bearing in mind that there's some very helpful guidance on this issue in the DWP's Health and Work Handbook, and that says that it's likely that the effects of an unresolved dispute on an employee's mental health can be greater if the disciplinary proceedings are postponed, and that whilst an employee may be unfit for work, they may well be fit to engage with the management process and, for example, to attend an investigation meeting or attend a disciplinary hearing. You could use that in speaking to occupational health and trying to move the process along. If, however, the employee is simply unable or unwilling to attend a meeting at all, then ultimately, of course, it will be necessary to complete the disciplinary in their absence. And in that scenario, they should be invited to make written representations before any disciplinary decision is made in their case.
You took as your third knotty problem the difficult area of an employee who is accused of criminal misconduct, not in the workplace but outside, and also not during the course of working hours. What is the connection between an employee's alleged criminal misconduct outside working hours and their employment rights?
Again, the starting point is the ACAS code, and that says that if an employee is charged with or convicted of a criminal offence, this is not normally in itself reason for disciplinary action. Consideration needs to be given to what effect the charge or conviction has on the employee's suitability to do their job and their relationship with their employer, work colleagues, and customers. Now that, of course, illustrates the need for caution from an employment perspective.
So in summary, Andreas, what are your top tips for employers facing this particular issue?
Provided the employer acts fairly and reasonably, then it doesn't necessarily have to await the outcome of criminal proceedings before taking disciplinary action. Criminal cases, of course, often take months or even years before coming to court. Now, another issue is that employees who have been charged with a criminal offence are frequently advised by their criminal lawyer not to answer any questions during the employer's disciplinary process. In that situation, the employer should give the employee the opportunity to give an explanation, but they shouldn't attempt to put undue pressure on them. The employer should notify the employee in writing that if they don't provide any information, then a disciplinary decision will be made on the basis of the available evidence. If the employer is contemplating dismissal, that needs to be made clear to the employee. Now, also bear in mind that employment case law emphasises that the more serious the allegation, the more thorough the investigation needs to be. But of course, there are limits to the extent to which employers can sensibly investigate alleged criminality in the private lives of their employees. And although they shouldn't simply accept information supplied by official authorities without question, or without giving the employee a fair chance to respond, employers are entitled to rely on official disclosures from the police and others, and sometimes it won't be necessary or even possible for employers to conduct their own investigation.
Thank you, Andreas. And that leads us nicely, Matt, into your topic, which centres around top tips for employers when responding to allegations of criminality against an employee. So what are the main differences between a criminal investigation and an employment investigation?
The key difference is that the police are able to utilise a range of powers to secure and seize material. A police investigation will also follow a very structured process. It does this as their investigation must be capable of bearing the weight of criminal proceedings. The burden of proof that they must eventually satisfy is to ensure that the tribunal is sure. The police are also obliged to follow all reasonable lines of inquiry. Those are lines that point towards the guilt of the suspect, but also those that point away. As part of any independent investigation, there may also be accompanying guidelines. An example of these is the Achieving Best Evidence guideline, and we will talk about this later in the podcast. These differences are a relevant consideration for those who practice in the field of employment, as any individual may be caught under the duties of investigating offences under Section 67(9) of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984.
Matt, are there any risks if an employment investigation is conducted before a criminal investigation takes place?
Yes. Law enforcement officials frequently lament a trampled crime scene, and this is the unavoidable consequence of an internal investigation taking place before a criminal investigation. The primary risks are contamination or the loss of evidence. Contamination can occur by osmosis. For example, if a witness has been spoken to, during the course of that conversation, new information is introduced, this may begin to change that witness's recall. Similarly, the very nature of taking a witness statement has a tendency towards perfection. As people consider drafts, they reflect and they tinker. Each iteration moves that witness further from their first raw account. Criminal law operates in an adversarial system. Therefore, every account, each iteration, matters. Unless all of this is captured and available to a law enforcement official, something is lost. The more significant the change, the greater the problem. As a result, a law enforcement official will want access to your investigation. If this is provided, then if a criminal prosecution is brought, it is likely to be disclosed to the defendant. If you refuse to provide it, then a criminal case may be entirely frustrated.
In a case whereby an employee might make a complaint about a colleague regarding potentially criminal misconduct which occurs outside the office, you suggested it would be important for the complainant to establish what the complainant wishes to achieve by reporting the matter to HR. Why is that important, do you think?
It is important as a criminal case can develop a life of its own. To use a simple example, we can take a complaint made against a solicitor. For the purposes of this example, the complainant asserts that there was an inappropriate kiss on the cheek at the end of the night. The complainant doesn't want anything to happen. They just don't want to work with the solicitor again. They want a bit of space. Upon receipt of the complaint, HR may feel compelled to investigate. Given the nature of the allegation, and the consensual kiss may be a sexual assault under Section 3 of the Sexual Offences Act 2003, the firm may feel compelled to tell the SRA. In turn, the SRA, who operate under a Memorandum of Understanding with the Association of Chief Police Officers, the predecessor of the National Police Chiefs Council, may feel that it is necessary to disclose the allegation to the police. The result is that a complaint of limited scope may turn into a criminal investigation in very short order.
You referred to the Achieving Best Evidence guidelines. What exactly are these, and why are they important?
The guidelines set out the best practice for capturing video recorded evidence in criminal proceedings. The Achieving Best Evidence scheme is a key component of special measures which are available to complainants in criminal cases. With a sexual offence, a complainant is automatically eligible for special measures under Section 17(4) of the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act 1999. Where a complainant's evidence has been captured under the ABU scheme, that video recording may be played to the jury as the complainant's evidence in chief. The benefit of this is that the complainant does not have to give their account twice. They are simply then required to attend court for the purposes of cross-examination. If the ABU guidance is not followed, then it may begin to affect the weight that can be placed on that ABU recording. The greater the breach of the guideline, the less weight that can be placed on the video.
Are you able to summarise for us the key points of guidance laid out in the ABE guidelines?
The initial questioning of the complainant should be limited to a brief account of what happened. The witness should be able to give this account using free recall. There should be open-ended or specific closed questions rather than forced choice, leading or multiple questions. You should ask no more questions than are necessary in the circumstances to take immediate action, and there should be a comprehensive note of the discussion which records the actual questions asked of a witness. This should occur for any account that is taken off camera. Once the substantive interview has begun, the ABE guidance sets out four phases. The first phase is to establish rapport. The second is for the complainant to provide a free narrative of their account. The third is for questioning, and the final for closure. When the account has been given, the interviewer should be mindful to ensure that they do not subconsciously or consciously indicate approval or disapproval of the information which is given.
Thank you, Jess, Andreas and Matt. The Kingsley Napier Employment Team provides regular breakfast briefings, events and training on issues such as these, which provide useful information on topical issues geared towards HR professionals. Our next event is scheduled for the morning of the 20th of November, when we will be providing a review of employment law developments over the past 12 months. If you wish to register your interest in this event and other such employment events, please do email us at events@kingsleynapley.co.uk. Thank you very much for listening.